Welcome to the Charter Cities Podcast. I'm Curtis Lockhart. On each episode, we invite a leading expert to discuss key trends in global development and the world of cities, including the role charter cities and innovative governance will play in humanity's new urban age. For more information, please follow us on social media or visit chartercitiesinstitute.org.
I'm Jeffrey Mason, head of research at the Charter Cities Institute. Joining me on the podcast today is Mark Lutter, the founder and executive chairman of CCI, and also the founder and CEO of Bravo Cities. We discuss the evolution of the Charter Cities ecosystem, exciting developments in Zanzibar and the Caribbean, and key factors which can make or break a Charter City project. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Hey, Mark. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So let's jump in. We'll talk a little bit about CCI, about your company, about the broader ecosystem. But let's sort of start with a quick refresher about why you first founded CCI, what CCI exists to do, and where do things stand now relative to when CCI was founded back in 2017?
Sure. So I started CCI. I mean, the story kind of starts before that, right? I got interested in charter cities just before graduate school when I heard about an attempt to build a free port in Somaliland. And I kind of started thinking about if governance matters for long-term economic outcomes, how can you change governance? Governance oftentimes is difficult to change on a national level. However, on a local level, it can be possible to have much more substantive changes. And there was a small community of folks interested in these ideas at the time. Paul Romer gave his Charter Cities talk in 2008 or 2009, I think, and the Seasteading Institute was founded in 2008. All right, Paul Romer got a lot of attention, like The Economist was writing about it, Financial Times, et cetera, had two projects, one in Madagascar, one in Honduras. Neither of them really worked, though the Honduras project, the law that he helped pass, is the basis for the law that now underlies Prospera and Ciudad Morazan. And so, yeah, when I finished graduate school, I realized that, one, like this space was kind of very high leverage in terms of having an impact on the world. And then two, that there was a, let's call it, lack of coordination in the space. So you had, for example, like the seasteading and seasteading descendants, most of them like related to or adjacent to Silicon Valley, who are interested in pushing the frontier of governance. One of their common lines is America runs on like 250-year-old code, meaning that, all right, how do we create legal and regulatory frameworks can attract the smartest engineers, lawyers, doctors, et cetera. They had that entrepreneurial spirit. They had that pushing the frontier, weren't thinking about deep relationships with new city developers or really how to engage government. One example, this was like 2014, 2015, the president of Honduras was going to come up to do an event with the Seasteading Institute, and the Seasteading Institute titled the event Disrupting Democracy, and the president of Honduras canceled. So there were some kind of mixed signals groups not knowing how to talk to each other. And me, coming from my background at George Mason, I thought I could perhaps try to bridge those worlds in terms of like mainstream development, in terms of like Silicon Valley entrepreneurial spirit, in terms of working with existing new city developments, in terms of talking to governments and figuring out how, rather than trying to reinvent everything, trying to start with what was kind of existing stakeholders that might be interested that were moving in what I thought was approximately the same direction, but generally unaware of these other paths that were happening. And then I think the other kind of element in my decision was I worked for what became Prospera, the company called New Way Capital that ended up starting Prospera. I switched when they started to focus on Honduras because I had spent time in Honduras in 2014, 2015. The law was passed in 2013. And at the time, this was like 5 years later and no project had gotten off the ground. It was very complicated. It was very confusing. I thought that it would be a mistake for the charter city space to just over-index on single people like Paul Romer or single places like Honduras. You put way too many of your eggs in one basket. And so, I mean, I was wrong in the sense that Prospera did kind of get set up. It was right in the sense that Honduras is still a very hard place and the Honduran government is currently quite antagonistic towards Prospera and the long-term prospects are a little bit unclear. So that was the impetus to kind of, how do you build a broad-based movement? How do you bring all these stakeholders together? How do you get the ideas out there? Also kind of thinking about how to focus on Africa a little bit more because Africa had the most rapid urbanization and also many countries in Africa are starting from relatively poor levels of governance that kind of have the opportunity for large improvements. So those were some of the inputs. The other input was kind of what structure should this idea take? It could be a nonprofit, it could be a try to build a city, it could be a fund structure. Prospera or New Way Capital, when I worked for them, was a fund structure. And so it was clear that there was not enough deal flow for a full fund structure. And I did not want to start a for-profit just because like raising money for that when you're kind of don't have a specific location lined up. I thought there was a lot of kind of movement building, stakeholder identification, stakeholder engagement, building out what this looks like in practice that was necessary before starting projects on the ground. I think those decisions were generally approximately right. And my interest was always to move over to the for-profit side. Initially, my expectation was in 3 to 5 years, I'd set up a fund. Now it's 6 years later and I haven't done that yet, but I think it was approximately correct in the sense of let's get the movement infrastructure in place. After that happens, you can start identifying opportunities and figuring out how to monetize them a little bit more effectively. So that's kind of the high level framing of why I started CCI and the context of how it's evolved till today.
So a lot of this background you're talking about, and I think this is some values that CCI embodies too, is this sort of Silicon Valley mindset of moving quickly and break things if that's what you have to do to get to where you need to go and not to be too slow, too conservative. It's easy, I think, to say that when we're talking about software or something, right? Okay, you fix the code, great. We're talking about policy or big infrastructure projects or things like that. How do you adapt that mindset to a new setting?
Yeah, you definitely need the entrepreneurial spirit, the willingness to kind of go to new places, talk to new people, this growth mentality, this openness of introductions, this openness of culture. But at the same time, given that one, you're dealing with a lot of stakeholders, some of whom are relatively conservative, right? Governments often don't want to do experiments. Cities require lots of upfront initial capital investment. And so you need to de-risk on that margin. The international development community is quite conservative in terms of new approaches. And so, right, like a lot of the challenge was like, how do you create this ethos, take the good things from Silicon Valley, but also adjust it to the specific context? And I think how we've seen that play out, at least at CCI, is to some extent in terms of hiring, right? When we, for example, hired from folks with a more traditional development background, oftentimes they haven't been great fits just because they've take a little bit of that, I don't know, conservatism and virtue signaling, and getting kind of younger, earlier career people who don't have that cultural conservative background, who are willing to take a little bit more risks, I think has paid off for us. And then, yeah, I mean, in addition, you can define Silicon Valley in like several ways. Like one is it's just like SaaS companies. And like the lessons from SaaS companies are probably not super applicable to charter cities. You can define it like much more broadly, where it is this kind of positive ethos of collaboration, of problem solving, of figuring it out. And you need to kind of adjust the model depending on the context, right? We're seeing that now with the rise of deep tech. Obviously, like nobody thought you could have like an iterative approach to rockets. And like SpaceX has an iterative approach to rockets that has been incredibly successful. And so thinking deeply about like, all right, what is the context? Can you start with a full city development? Do you want to start with like a small amount of land, build a town, then buy additional land pieces? Do you cut one deal with governments? Do you cut like a bunch of small incremental deals as you build up momentum over time? I think both approaches could work. And a lot of it depends on what is the project, who are the local stakeholders involved, and like how do you identify those people that are willing to work with you in this kind of very large, somewhat undefined project and kind of figure things out over time.
So talking about stakeholders, and right, there's lots of different people involved, both on the financial side, who your prospective residents are, who lives in the area where you want to build these things, government, policymakers, right? And one of the key lessons I think that's come out of a lot of the development literature looking at what causes policy change, what causes reform, or what allows these things to happen is when you generate buy-in at the elite level and sort of at the policymaker, the business elite level, and sort of creating these powerful constituencies that are supportive of a particular idea or project. Now, how do you think that works, one, in general for charter cities, but then two, across regions? How does that differ in, say, Africa, where we've done some work, versus, say, the Caribbean, where we've also had some ongoing projects?
Yeah, so when Paul Romer came out, he did a TED Talk. He was getting coverage. Everybody knew this is one of the best economists. He later won a Nobel Prize. like there was a lot of interest. Also, when seasteading might have like the most, for like any nonprofit, the most like media attention for the amount of dollars in. When it launched, there was a tremendous amount of attention, like lots of press, lots of coverage, lots of interest. When I started CCI, I, let's say, optimistically assumed I could get comparable levels of coverage, and that was not the case. And so part of it is just creating a powerful meme that gets everybody excited, that gets everybody talking. It's a little bit like with new media channels, it can be a little bit easier to do that. And then two, if you have the right like initial stakeholders who can provide legitimacy, then that cascades down. Part of the challenge of this like multi-stakeholder engagement is, right, at the country level, people might not know who some of like our supporters are, or like they don't know who Ed Glaser is, who's spoken at our conferences. And so like identifying who these key stakeholders are, and then who the key, let's call it, people in those stakeholder groups who can help like get those stakeholders to start talking about it to build a broader coalition. I think the other kind of part of this is making sure that these coalitions are sustainable. Because with seasteading and with the original charter city space, they weren't sustainable. In part because they couldn't get traction on the ground, and in part because they got attention, in part they had this grand vision and story to tell, and then there was a lack of execution success that caused a lot of people who are interested to kind of fade away and maybe write it off or maybe just ignore it. And so what we've tried to do, our initial strategy at CCI, was to partner with existing new cities, right? Because new cities take a very long time. How do we partner with them, get those early wins that can then be translated to something more broad instead of taking 5 years to set a city up, right? Like find somebody who's already done a lot of the initial work, work with them, make it a little bit better, get a better governance framework, maybe target like tenants a little bit more carefully, whatever that might be. And then that allows you to kind of get those early wins. And so I think a lot of the challenge and opportunity is figuring out how to build that sustainable momentum, how to build that set of best practices, how to build that community that can end up building a lot of cities, right? The goal of Charter Cities Institute isn't to build cities, it's to build the ecosystem that then can become a force multiplier for multiple cities getting developed. And I think in the last year or two, we've really seen that come to fruition. When we held the conference in Kigali last year, we had, I don't know, a dozen, 18 new city developers there. We had a pitch competition, and I think there was a lot of excitement at the event and a lot of like realization of, oh, right, if you're adding 1 billion new urban residents, you need a lot of work in terms of building infrastructure, building housing, creating governance frameworks that allow these urban residents to have a better life. And so in terms of thinking about this coalition building, like there's, I guess, two types of approaches. There's this like kind of top-down approach where you create a general overarching framework, get everybody really excited, and then use that as leverage lower ground. The other kind of more bottom-up approach is to identify specific stakeholders on the ground that you want to partner with and figure out what can you do to kind of really accelerate those projects. And CCI has been taking this kind of dual approach, one setting this broad vision, mostly in Africa, but bringing together all these stakeholders. We've engaged the African Union. We had African Export Import Bank, one of the largest development banks on the continent, be a large sponsor at our event. And then the other part is to, how do you actually build up momentum so you're not just telling a story, so you have these specific projects? And I think in Zanzibar, we've really identified a very strong local partner, multiple local partners that we believe can really scale into a substantive city and kind of provide, let's call it, proof of concept for this broad idea. And then in the Caribbean, we've also started working closely with some local stakeholders in terms of figuring out how to unlock a potentially tremendous asset.
I've personally been at CCI for 5 years, and you've been able to see, I think, this broader ecosystem really start to take shape. And you referenced Kigali, our conference that we had there last November. Something that really stood out to me from that, that was particularly impactful, is that so on one side of the stage, we were able to have one of our partner city projects, in this case, Enyimba Economic City, who raised a couple hundred million from Export Import Bank. And then over on the other side of the stage is the person responsible from Afrexim's side for the deal, and to be able to put that completed circle on a showcase in front of a whole room full of people who are thinking about, is this something that my institution can invest in, or is this something that I can build or whatever, getting that squared circle, I think, is proven to be really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then also finding the projects that are more advanced. For example, Tatu City, they recently had an Economist article written about them, which the Charter Cities Institute was kind of featured discussing. They've got 5,000 acres north of Nairobi. They've got about 20,000 residents. Like on my LinkedIn, every few weeks I see, oh, there's another factory or whatever, investing $100 million, creating a lot of jobs, and really demonstrating like, oh, it's possible. And not only is it possible, like here's the playbook for how it's done. Here's the people who can help do it. And building out that broader community for knowledge sharing. So it's not this secret knowledge, but it's this kind of semi-publicly available information that can inspire other projects, other countries to really start adapting the same mechanisms that can hopefully lead to more sustainable economic growth in the future in these regions.
And I'm curious how you think with this sort of broader ecosystem building with, say, high profile efforts like, say, Akon's new city, which maybe draw a lot of detraction. We just saw, you know, in the last couple of weeks, Idris Elba's Sherbro Island project in Sierra Leone has gotten quite a bit of press, and our director Curtis, he was quoted in Le Monde about it just the other day. How do these types of projects, which in terms of most of the ones we've engaged with, are a little bit different in terms of their backing and their structure, their strategy, how do they fit in this ecosystem?
Yeah, so cities are hot right now. I mean, Kanye West was talking about doing a city, right? You've got in El Salvador, they want to do Bitcoin City. And so there is a lot of interest in new cities. I think the challenge is much of this interest doesn't understand like the underlying dynamics of what makes cities work, of what makes them successful, right? With Akon City, for example, they have these fantastic renders that look beautiful, but might not be affordable to the average resident in the country, that might not be able to attract residents, investors, businesses to relocate there. And so what I would like to see, I guess, happen is for this kind of consensus of best practices become more established, where then these new city developers or these celebrities or governments or whoever it is, when they say like, we want to build a new city, they actually can get in contact with people with real on the ground expertise who can help guide them like, okay, how big do you want it? What's your target market? Get realistic about what it takes to actually get these projects done so they're not white elephants, but instead like can really materially help the people on the ground. One of the reasons I started the Charter Cities Institute is when I was in graduate school, I did a little bit of consulting work for a new city project in Kazakhstan. And the government had given a very large land grant to some Kazakh businessmen, and they were flying in like the world's leading experts on cities. And I remember having a conversation with like a distinguished professor from MIT. And I mentioned like, look, zoning like increases the housing crisis. And his response was, no, really? And I was like, look, I don't think I'm particularly dogmatic. If he said like, yes, it can increase housing prices, but there's also like quality of the neighborhood character. And when you're planning something and you want the initial mass of people to move, you want to give them comfort that where they're going to move is going to be like a good investment for the next 10, 20 years, right? Whatever it is, right? Like, I'm open to those arguments. There's a lot of margins on which you can play with this to make it work. But he was literally completely ignorant of the fact that like zoning and land use can lead to an increase in housing prices. Similarly, there was a discussion of like, we can put the finance center here, we can put it here, pointing to different parts of the map. We can have tall buildings, we can have medium-sized buildings. That was just what I thought was an obvious point. Unless you have a legal system that can protect that capital, nobody's going to want to do business there, right? You can build whatever fancy buildings you want. If you look at finance centers around the world, they're basically all common law, right? Unless there is a common law protected like finance system with independent judges, nobody's going to park hundreds of millions, billions of dollars there. And these are points that I thought were, at least from my perspective, somewhat obvious, but these kind of experts who are being assembled for cities were unaware of them. And I think that's a kind of challenge generally is people go to, if you're kind of a local businessman or a celebrity, you say, okay, I want to build a city. And then you might go to like Harvard or MIT or right, like whatever, what are the fanciest institutions I can find? Then you go to the people there, and the people there might be very good at designing like city blocks or might have like really good expertise in one domain. And they assume the expertise in their domain scales to a city, but it doesn't, right? Like a city is not just 1,000 city blocks. There are step changes in how to think about like the organizational structure, the development structure as you scale up. And oftentimes these people just don't spend a lot of time thinking about it and don't know. And then two is the feedback loop for cities is just extremely long. Going back to the Silicon Valley analogy, the feedback loop for companies tends to be very short. If you put out a app or a product that people don't like, nobody buys it, and then you like lose money. And so there is a short feedback loop that can be course correcting, Well, with cities, oftentimes you need to put down very substantial amounts of capital for initial development, and you don't get a sense of how well that's working until a much longer time period. And then two, the causal chain oftentimes can be a little bit unclear. Are people moving to the city because you have a rapidly urbanizing population? Are they moving to the city because there is an existing demand function? Are they moving to the city because you have actually created a unique value proposition? And so it can be hard to say, like, okay, people aren't moving because of a bad location or because of bad zoning or because you haven't found the right anchor tenants or because you've created a legal system. Like, the legal system isn't attractive to businesses. And so I think you've got basically experts who don't spend their time thinking about cities. And then you have a very long feedback loop that causes a lot of these new city projects, the kind of much more public and open ones, to just attract like the wrong kind of teams that then end up oftentimes failing to execute on several margins that cause people to write off these projects.
So let's look then at some of the projects that we're working directly with. So one of the ones that you mentioned is Zanzibar, and this is for on CCI's end. This is where, let's say, the bulk of our sort of on the ground efforts are currently targeted. So can you give an overview of what the project is in Zanzibar and what CCI is contributing and sort of what the vision is?
Sure. So this started about a year ago. We met Daniel Yu, who's the founder of Wasoko, and he had relocated his company to Zanzibar. It's a fast-growing e-commerce company in Africa. And so he had been pushing the Silicon Zanzibar initiative, where the Silicon Zanzibar initiative was focused on attracting other companies, other talent to Zanzibar. And on some margin, it's a pretty easy sell, right? Zanzibar is beautiful. It's got a nice climate. The people are welcoming. It's got an airport that's very connected, reasonably reliable internet. And so he was kind of pushing that angle. Curtis and I went to Zanzibar a year ago, February, I think, where we just gave some informal talks on what CCI is doing. And the developer of Fumbatown is a town that's about 30 minutes south of Stone Town, the main city in Zanzibar, about 20 minutes south of the airport. He's got 60 hectares of land, so 150 acres, and had built about 600 units, kind of a variety, some houses, some one bedrooms. So we met the local developer. The CEO's name is Sebastian. The company's called CPS, and he's building Fumbatown. It's about 30 minutes south of Stone Town, the primary city, 20 minutes south of the airport. They built about 600 units, a variety of units, right, in terms of studios up to like kind of luxurious waterfront villas. And we talked about CCI, talked about urban expansion, how to create improved special economic zones, improved governance to accelerate. And he realized like, oh, this is great. Like, this really lines up with my vision, what I'm trying to do. And so last summer, I believe it was August, maybe July, we met the president of Zanzibar. And Zanzibar is, it's not a country, it's part of Tanzania, but it's like Hong Kong was until China passed the national security law. It's kind of one country, two systems, because historically it has been independent. And so Zanzibar, while it's part of Tanzania, has a lot of local authority to deal with kind of local issues, right? Diplomacy, monetary policy is at the union level, but there is a pretty wide swath of area that's at the Zanzibari level. So we met with the president. Just for a little bit more context, Fumba Peninsula is a peninsula south of Stone Town, the capital, and the peninsula is about 3,000 hectares, so almost the size of Manhattan, so quite a large amount of land. And it is a special economic zone that was set up 30 years ago. And we kind of met the president, talked to him about, look, how can we improve this special economic zone? How can we build like a proper satellite city here? What would this look like? The president said, this is our dream, and set up a task force to execute on it. And so since then, we've had a number of our team members move to Zanzibar voluntarily. I think they just realized like, hey, living in Zanzibar might be a little bit more fun than DC. So we've got, I think, four or five people on the ground there. And we've kind of started working on a number of initiatives. And like in thinking about city development, right, this is kind of a little bit of a challenge, and the opportunity is there's a lot of different moving pieces. One is, how do you get the governance right, make it easy to do business, make it easy to build new things? Two is, how do you get land? Three is, how do you get the people there? What is your target market? Four is like, who are the businesses and tenants that we're going to move? And so CCI is helping to tackle a lot of these different issues. So in terms of, right, people, we're hosting a festival, a 5-week festival called Zanzalu. And this is inspired by Zuzalu. Zuzalu was a 2-month pop-up city in Montenegro last year organized by Vitalik Buterin. They got 200 people for 2 months and then about 100 people coming in and out. And it was interesting in the sense that there was a pretty high density of talent, very interesting conversations, and it was a lot of fun. And so inspired by that, we're organizing this 5-week festival in Zanzibar, where we're going to bring 75 to 100 people there. We're partnering with a local university, the State University of Zanzibar, going to teach some workshops on blockchain. Zanzalu is separate from CCI, but like lots of CCI people are involved. We're going to have a government weekend. We're going to have like a startup weekend to bring companies, startups, as well as small and medium sized enterprises to Zanzibar, just to kind of like showcase, hey, look, here's what's building. Here's what's going on. Like Zanzibar's cool. Maybe you want to relocate. Maybe you want to spend more time here. Just increase the funnel of talent. Another thing that we're doing is CCI is partnered with the African School of Economics. The African School of Economics is a university founded by Leonard Wanchakan, who's a professor at Princeton. They have campuses in Benin, Cote d'Ivoire, and Nigeria. So CCI is helping to open their first campus in East Africa. And there, in addition to the campus, we're also opening an African urban lab. And the idea is, at least with what CCI is working on, is creating this kind of like teaching hospital, but for economics and economic development and urbanization. So there, we're starting with a professional degree program. And that's going to start in the fall. And then the following year, we'll start with a master's program. And with we're doing like the long-term vision is for this to be a top-tier research university. And I was speaking to Leonard recently. He was like, yeah, everybody I talked to is like, yeah, I'd love to come teach in Zanzibar. Like, I'll teach there for a few weeks. I'll teach there for a semester. It's a pretty easy sell to say like, hey, come and hang out in Zanzibar, right? So I think we'll be able to attract a lot of teaching talent. And we're currently thinking through how to attract students, how to set the budgeting, how to set financing. But that can be an anchor tenant in this city development because universities attract a lot of people. You need housing. It makes the area dynamic, kind of a hub of innovation. We are also partnering with CPS, the town developer, right? They have 60 hectares. They've planned for 30 of it. So we're working with them to plan the next 30 hectares. Who are the target markets? One thing about the town is currently the cheapest units are $40,000. Which is quite affordable for an American. But if you're Zanzibari, right, it's probably out of your price range. And so one of the things we want to do is figure out how to make more affordable housing, how to make it accessible to the average Zanzibari. We're thinking about how to create a mortgage market, because right now in Zanzibar, the financial institutions aren't very developed. So how to create financial institutions to allow Zanzibaris to take advantage of these opportunities. And so thinking through how to push the price point down. We were on a task force with the government last year to update their investment law. And currently, they're setting up a task force on the special economic zone law to figure out, okay, how can we improve this special economic zone law to make this zone more dynamic, to attract more investment? And then we're working with the Zanzibar Investment Promotion Agency, which manages the special economic zones. And we're working with them on a strategic plan to lay out, okay, how do we really take advantages of the kind of value that Zanzibar can provide? How do we attract investment? How do we create jobs for Zanzibaris? How do we make this kind of economy a lot more dynamic?
So right, a lot of different moving parts here. Tie this kind of all back up in a bow, and in say 10 years or whatever timeline you feel is appropriate to comment on.
Yeah, so our goal in 25 years is to have a satellite city of about 80,000 people. Zanzibar will add 800,000 new urban residents over the next 20 years. And so 10% of that, most of them are going to be kind of in or around Stonetown, which is like the major city on the island. Currently, most of them are living in basically informal settlements. And so when you drive through, you can see these settlements. They tend to be relatively dense the closer you get to the city. But oftentimes, they might struggle with running water or sewage or electricity. And so this is part of pushing the price point down to basically offer an alternative to these people who otherwise might be living in informal settlements. But now you can live in something formal where you do have running water, electricity, sewage, like the important standards of modernity.
And property rights.
And property rights. And we think we can capture about 10% of that population. That's our goal. In addition to that, we want to make Zanzibar, and particularly Fumba Town and Fumba City, a hub for innovation in East Africa. Currently, Nairobi is the startup capital of East Africa. And so what we want to do over time is really expand on this Silicon Zanzibar initiative to attract companies to relocate, to attract people to relocate. Right. In addition to the African School of Economics, there's also the State University of Zanzibar, which we are partnering with on Zanzalu. And then there is the Indian Institute of Technology. They opened their first overseas campus ever. It's located about 5 minutes from Pumbatown. They opened last fall. So there is already a good university core there that's being developed and being built out, which is a really important part of an innovation ecosystem. And so part of this doing events, promotion work, is figuring out how to identify, like, who are the people who might relocate to Zanzibar? Maybe it's for a second home, or maybe it's full time. And how do you get that critical mass of people? How do you attract people from Dar es Salaam? How do you attract people from Nairobi? How do you attract people from South Africa or other places in the region to make this a really dynamic hub? So I guess the 10-year vision is kind of twofold. It's one, create a really dynamic hub of innovation in East Africa. And then two, it's also how do we push the price point down on this development to make it accessible to the average Zanzibari? And our hope is demonstrating this partnership with government, this partnership with local institutions, this affordability, this dynamic economic engine can help convince other countries, hey, this works. Let's figure out how we can take some of the lessons here, go work in mainland Tanzania, go work in Kenya, go work in other places that are facing similar challenges in terms of creating jobs, attracting capital, and creating housing for rapidly growing populations.
And in thinking about attracting not just the digital nomad type model that you do see a lot of Ridge City projects target or look at, but pushing the price point down and serving this local population, what are some of the other viable economic opportunities in a place like Zanzibar beyond this kind of information ecosystem?
Yeah. So right now, Zanzibar is largely a tourism economy, and there can definitely be more tourism. But in addition to that, you want to diversify your economic bucket. And the special economic zones in Zanzibar already have low taxes. And figuring out how to provide effective infrastructure in terms of roads, ports. Right now, the primary port in Zanzibar is in Stone Town, and driving there, like, it's downtown Stone Town, so the roads are always pretty clogged. So, right, like, how do you figure out, okay, like, there is some seaweed production that's then exported, there is fishing, but how do you start going one step up in the supply chain? How do you do early stage processing in Zanzibar, like early stage seaweed processing, maybe fish processing, right, whatever that might be? We've started looking into that. We haven't gotten super advanced there, but starting to lay the groundwork for, like, how do we start to, because yeah, the information technology is great, but that's not going to be available to the average Zanzibari who just doesn't have the educational background, who doesn't have the access to really become part of it immediately. And historically, right, development typically comes in stages, right? You start with early stage industrialization and then move up the supply chain over time. And identifying, all right, what are the key comparative advantages of Zanzibar? How can we attract those businesses, both internationally as well as help grow existing businesses in Zanzibar to start meeting that market, to start exporting more, to diversify away from tourism so it can become a full-fledged dynamic economy with those different parts? And we believe this is part of this broader economic strategy that we're helping with Zanzibar Investment Promotion Agency on their strategic plan, as well as identifying these local partners on the ground. There is already, for example, a port on the Fumba Peninsula, figuring out what that port's capacity is, what that growth plan is, how that might link into these other elements of economic development that are taking place.
Now, let's jump across an ocean or two and talk about the Caribbean and what you're doing there with your company.
Sure. So I guess to back up a little bit, I left the Charter Cities Institute about 2 years ago. I'm still executive chairman, but I'm no longer that involved in the day-to-day. And the impetus for that was this project in the Caribbean where a concerned resident reached out to me and basically said, look, we have an existing special economic zone that's not doing as well as it could be. The government's interested in modernizing it, reviving it. There's a lot of available land. There's a great location. The infrastructure is good. And I was just like, holy shit, this is amazing. A lot of the challenge of charter cities is location, right? You can have the best institutions in the world, but if they're in Antarctica, nobody's going to want to live there. And so institutions have exist in a specific place in a specific time to serve the needs of people. So you need to match the institutional environment to the economy, to the local population, to all of these dynamics to ensure that it can be plugged into regional supply chains, to regional migration patterns, et cetera. And this was a fantastic opportunity. So we met the prime minister a handful of times, brought some investors down. Prime minister was quite interested. And unfortunately, it's a very complex multi-stakeholder engagement, and we lost a little bit of momentum. And what's happened recently is that momentum has started to pick up again. We've identified some very strong local partners on the ground, including a landowner and a local entrepreneur who kind of have existing relationships with governments, have some of the resources necessary to really execute on this project. And so we're starting to chat about it a little bit more. right? Here, the short-term vision is what the government wants is jobs and tax revenue, right? What the people want is jobs. The island has had pretty bad luck with hurricanes, and it's 60 miles from the U.S., and there isn't a single four-star hotel on the beach. And so with that location, with beautiful beaches, turquoise water, tourism is really low-hanging fruit. So what the government wants, what the people want, is immediate job creation. And so how do you start with that? The island also has a small industrial sector as well as a small logistics sector. So it's really, how do you pick this low-hanging fruit and start to accelerate it? Right? The long-term vision is to make this a tech hub. And like, everybody wants to build their own Silicon Valley, but basically nobody succeeds because like Silicon Valley isn't about building some buildings and calling it Silicon Valley or like Silicon whatever. Silicon Valley is about the people and their relationships. And so long-term, what we are starting to do is build out those relationships with the entrepreneurs, the investors in Silicon Valley who might open an office there, who might have a second home there, right? Whatever that might be. And once you get those personal relationships built out, once you get that, then it starts becoming an attractive tech hub. And this island, when we spoke with the prime minister, we talked about figuring out how to expedite work and residence visas. And so the U.S., lots of people want to live in the U.S., but the U.S. has a relatively complicated immigration system. So we believe that this could be quite attractive to people who want access to the U.S. market, labor market, capital market, et cetera, but might struggle to get in the U.S. because of the U.S. stringent visa system, or might not want to locate in the U.S. because of the U.S. tax requirements. And so figuring out how to attract those people over the long term, at the same time creating jobs for the locals and helping attract some who might have left to other islands or other countries just because of the lack of opportunity on this current island.
So what does the timeline on that look like?
Hopefully an announcement this summer or this fall. There's a lot of on the ground stuff that has to be worked out, but we're chatting with investors who are quite interested. And some of our partners are discussing with other local landowners in terms of how to figure out how to structure a transaction in a way that benefits all parties and can really unlock this value. So over the last few months, things have picked up substantially. And I'm spending most of my time on this island in April, and then I'll be spending a lot of time there over the next 6 months. And so we're starting to fly in some of our experts to meet some of our local partners. Our local partners are coming to Silicon Valley in late April. We're really trying to figure out, like, all right, how do we create this framework to work together? How do we structure this deal in a way that all the stakeholders are happy with and really creates this growth engine for the country as well as the region?
So one of the things we've seen in places that have successfully grown quickly, say over the course of the move of the 20th century, a place like Singapore, Dubai, something like that, these sort of quickly developing countries that really were quickly successful, they, to varying degrees, relied on a motivated, competent, and highly aligned state. Whereas a lot of the places, social or policy entrepreneurs, whatever you'd like to call them, try to work in sub-Saharan Africa, other places, right? The capacity isn't there. And you could definitely do a lot worse than Zanzibar or in the Caribbean where you're looking at, but still in the grand scheme of things, relatively on the lower end of state capacity. And right, I think this sort of charter city idea falls in that sort of big push camp. So how do you get a project like Zanzibar, like Fumbatown in Zanzibar, or like what you're trying to do in the Caribbean, how do you sort of push it across the finish line in a sort of challenging environment from an institutional or capacity point of view?
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on the local context. So far, when we're meeting kind of politicians, heads of government, there's generally excitement about what we're trying to do. A lot of the challenge comes down to the politicians and heads of government have a lot of demands on their time. And then when we start engaging the kind of senior officials to partner with, oftentimes, because this is a new idea, it doesn't fall neatly in one bucket. And so it's like, okay, is this my bucket? Is this somebody else's bucket? There's a little bit of a, let's call it, education process to communicate, okay, this is what we're trying to do. This is the vision. This is how it interlocks with these different departments. And that just requires a lot of elbow grease and work on the ground, right? There's no magic wand. It requires spending time on the ground, working closely with these people. It requires demonstrating you have the financial commitment, you have energy around it, right? One of the things, for example, in Zanzibar, what we're hoping is that Zanzalu, it's easy enough to set up a meeting when it's just you, two people, and a minister, and the minister says, okay, this is cool, but then sometimes things get lost in the next steps. But if you get 100 really smart, interesting people show up, you have media attention, people are going to pay a little bit more attention to your proposals, to what you're doing. When you partner with locals who are some of the most successful investors on the island, the government's going to be a little bit more interested in what you have to say. All right, when you can bring investors that have the potential to move very large amounts of capital, right, the government's going to listen a little bit more closely. And so a lot of it is, the wrong way to put it, is social engineering. But like, how do you create this social dynamic, this proof of credibility to local stakeholders to get them to buy into the vision and to get them to understand what you're bringing to the table, what their role is? And there's no one easy way to do this. So for example, in Zanzibar, as we've been talking about, right, what we're looking at is, okay, we do Zanzalu. We're going to do a city builders retreat to bring some of the top city builders in Africa in late June or July. We're starting a university, right? All of these things open doors. They make people take us a little bit more seriously. They get a little bit more buy-in for the broader vision. One of the things we should also do is figure out how to tell a website of get a website for Fumba City. Because as like even we're talking, like I sometimes don't even remember all of the different components of what we're doing. How do we tell that story really cleanly and effectively to build up that local consensus that this is good, people benefit, this is creating this type of value? In the Caribbean, what we're looking at doing is, after we can get a contract for the relevant assets, what we would explore is, okay, now, how do we make this very compelling to the government? Not just there's going to be an asset transfer, but there's going to be an asset transfer or new shareholders. In addition to that, all of these other things happen, right? And what that would look like in particular, we've already started talking with the university about opening a research center there that can eventually grow into a full-fledged institution. We've had very early conversations with people about opening an office there. We've reached out to potential airport partners, to potential resort partners. So that way, as we're doing due diligence on the asset before we close, and we're talking about government, how do we modernize this special economic zone? How do we make it really dynamic, really business friendly? We can say, look, we're not just doing this, but we also have all of these other stakeholders, potential investors lined up. So when you modernize it, it's not just like, oh, here's some promises, but oh, it's going to be modernized. And then you've got a resort partner, and then you've got a research center, and then you've got 30, 40 small, medium-sized enterprises that want to open an office there. Then you've got these startups that might want to relocate there, right? And that just makes it much more attractive to the government because it's much less of a risk to them. That way, they know the population will benefit. They know that they increase their chances of getting reelected. It becomes, I think, a much stronger value proposition to them. And so a lot of this is this massive coordination game of how do you line up all these people and how do you get them to start cascading such that by the time you actually have the jurisdiction established, you've got a huge amount of momentum, you create a lot of jobs, you create tax revenue, everybody is happy, and you can start the process to building a wonderful, globally competitive city.
We've talked a bit in detail about what's going on in Zanzibar with CCI and in the Caribbean with Bravos, your company. What else for folks who are sort of broadly interested in the space or just want to go follow where the most realistic, that the best projects are? What should people be paying attention to or looking for over the next 1 to 5 years?
Well, I'm biased, so I would say Zanzibar and the Caribbean. But maybe before answering that question, just to go into a little bit more depth about Bravos. The goal of Bravos is to be the charter city development company. And so the role we hope to play in Zanzibar, what we'll likely do is raise a small fund, $20, $30 million, as basically a city development fund. And that will be committed to additional land acquisition, to strategic investments. Maybe we realize, okay, look, if we build some of these buildings faster, we can sell them. Currently, they're being built on pay-as-you-go plans. So if you want to buy a house, you put, let's say, 20% down, you pay over 3 to 5 years. They build the house while you're paying. Maybe it can go faster if we can create some sort of financing instrument that says, okay, we'll build it and we're confident the demand is there, and then you move faster. And so a lot of the question in some of these projects is, all right, like we've got the location, we've got some of the initial alignment, but how do you start pushing the accelerator? And in the long term, the goal is once we get the Caribbean project closed, once we have Zanzibar really accelerating, then with Bravos, what I'm hoping is that once you have that credibility, currently the charter city space has been a lot of pushing, right? Pushing on local governments, pushing on local stakeholders. Ideally, it gets to a pull situation where people reach out to us. governments reach out to us, landowners reach out to us and say, hey, look, we have this opportunity. Do you want to partner with us? And as we build up both the credibility as well as the financial resources, we believe by having some of the most successful projects in the space, we can hopefully become a long-term global partner for governments and for people in terms of developing new cities and related projects. And so I've been spending a bit of my time thinking about like, okay, what does it mean to actually scale this? You got the initial projects off the ground. How do you build the team? How do you build the brand? How do you build the relationships? It takes me 2 to 3 years to learn a new skill, right? I was terrible at negotiating in the Caribbean when I started. Now I think I'm like, okay at it. I'm not sure I'm great at it, but I'm like, not terrible at it anymore. I was terrible at managing when I started CCI. Now I think I'm like kind of good at it. And so as we're building up this knowledge, this skill set, how do we start building up the broader team to be able to execute on these opportunities? Because Africa alone will have 1 billion new urban residents over the next 30 years. So there is kind of a massive market out there for better housing, for better cities, and figuring out how to provide these services to this market, I think is really critical for a better future for humanity. I guess to your broader question about like what other projects outside the ones that we've mentioned am I interested and excited about? And like, what does the space broadly look like? So we've mentioned some of them already, right? Tatu City is doing very well. It's probably the best. It's not really a charter city. They have a special economic zone, but it's like got definitely charter city elements. And so that's definitely one to look at. Another one that attended our conference that their CEO is an advisor to CCI, John Vannon, who of Small Farm Cities, they've developed a model to start small, basically build tomato farming, tilapia farming for 100 people, then 1,000 people, then 10,000. They've developed a really innovative, scalable model that I'm really looking forward to see how it progresses. You've got other projects kind of adjacent, right? You've got California Forever in California. That's acquired a huge amount of land an hour or two northeast of San Francisco. And they're, I think, working on a referendum this summer or this fall to get local buy-in that will allow them to start development. Though I don't think that will be sufficient because you also have CEQA lawsuits, the California Environmental Quality Act, right? It's really hard to build things in California. So, but their team seems quite strong. So I hope they succeed. I've got a friend who's working on new city projects in Texas, looking at kind of acquiring land outside of Austin, between Austin and San Antonio, and sort of like the Zanzibar model, starting small, getting proof of concept and acquiring additional tracts of land as it grows. The projects that folks are probably more familiar with, you've got Prospera in Honduras. I was down there about a month ago, and I think they've recently got a lot of momentum with Vitalia starting to really attract potential residents, get businesses to relocate there. And they recently survived the main challenge of the government trying to basically ban them. And the government needed to pass legislation twice. They passed it once, but they didn't have the votes the second time. So they solved the immediate hurdle, but the government is still hostile. And so I think they need to figure out how to, I don't know if it's cut a deal or get that longer term staying power. Because when you have that hostile government, it's really hard to grow, even if there is some energy and excitement. You have Praxis, which is looking at acquiring land in the Mediterranean and has been quite successful with kind of fundraising and early stage development and community building. And I think they're saying that they're planning to make an announcement this year, if I remember correctly. And so hopefully they'll be able to make a strong announcement, get land and get moving. I guess the other part of this space is like Zuzalu, right? The pop-up city model and the network state model added a lot of energy and interest in this space. And it's not fully charter cities, but it's adjacent to it. And so it does provide like one of the initial challenges with new city development is how do you get that initial critical mass? And if you can host events in over several months, get hundreds of people to show up, right? They're not all going to stay, but you get a handful of them who stay and they tell their friends about it. That can really help with the initial critical mass building. And we're seeing Prospera use it as a tool. We're using it as a tool in Zanzibar. We'll probably use it as a tool in the Caribbean. It is a very useful tool for brand building, for initial resident attraction. And that's added a lot of energy, excitement, and dynamism. If we think about the broader space and its potential success, to place it in the broader geopolitical context. When I started CCI, the China threat was looming large, but it was still kind of at the peak of Pax Americana. And now I think it has become clear that Pax Americana is probably in decline, right? The Houthis, some like non-state actor, is able to shut down a major shipping lane. We're seeing with Russia and Ukraine, with Israel, with the potential in Taiwan, a lot of these regional challenges, right? When I think about what that means for charter cities. As unipolarity recedes, we're going to see a lot of regional experiments. Some of these will be charter cities, but some of these won't, right? It's just going to mean a lot of different regional governance things happening that were probably a little bit suppressed in the unipolar world. And I think charter cities are one of those kind of institutional innovations that I think governments will be a little bit more receptive to, that can potentially kind of help provide a lot of this, I don't know, interest, excitement, capital to help some of these regions that as uncertainty rises, they can figure out how to serve their citizens better by creating these opportunities, by creating this investment, by unlocking this potential. And so if I think about what the charter city space looks like over the next 5 years or over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a lot of initial traction. But none of that initial traction has really hit escape velocity yet. Like, it's all kind of early stage startups. And I think the key over the next 5 years is for some of these projects to hit escape velocity. Like, how do you actually get cash flow positive? How do you start paying back investors? How do you get good residents? How do you get good tenants? How do you get good businesses to relocate there? And as that model is proven out, as it's demonstrated, right, you get a lot more investor commitment, you get a lot more governments being open, you get people more willing to move, companies more willing to relocate. And so I think the next 5 years, what people should watch for, in addition to the Caribbean, in addition to Zanzibar, is just like, are projects hitting this escape velocity? Are they really getting there? And once they get there, I think we'll see the space really blow up.
It's exciting, and I can't wait to see it blow up. Mark, thanks for chatting.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. We love engaging with our listeners, so please always feel free to reach out. Contact information is listed in the show notes. To find out more about the work of the Charter Cities Institute, please follow us on social media or visit chartercitiesinstitute.org.